On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we discuss how the Orioles got here. What is going on the mound for these O's after another blowout, courtesy of the New York Yankees on Tuesday. Then we welcome a special guest. It's Chris Bubich of the Kansas City Royals talking about his strong start to the season. Then we dig into the new City Connect uniforms from the Chicago White Sox, which we are not huge fans of. Couple other notes from early in the week before we say goodbye. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world not quite old enough to pitch for the Orioles. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. You're 30. I'm 29.
Which makes me slightly more likely to receive a call from the Orioles front office, say, hey, can you give us a few innings? It's Wednesday and the Orioles just got blown out again. Before we get to our special guest, Chris Bubich, Orioles could sure use him.
Boy.
And before we talk about the White Sox City Connects, this is going to be an interesting episode where it's like, what gets Jake more angry? The Orioles pitching staff or the White Sox new City Connect jerseys? Generally, we try to have, you know, a good positive. Like, we don't want people listening to us getting angry, perturbed. But you know what? I feel like today you are well within your right on multiple accounts to kind of unleash some fury.
I'm roiled up on a Wednesday morning.
So this is going to be a fun episode. But Jake, indeed, our opener today is whatever is going on in Baltimore.
So last week we talked about how in recent years, my fandom, the layers of it have peeled away and I no longer root for the home team, AKA the Baltimore Orioles. And that is true, right? I think that is true. As I drove away from Camden Yards yesterday, leaving the park at 6:28 so that I could return home to New York. I was there for pregame there the day before. When a cascade, a barrage, a cavalcade of home runs off Kyle Gibson gave the Yankees a 4-0 lead in the first, my frustration did not come from a place of bias or familial history or fandom, but rather for a general frustration for humanity as a whole.
And yeah, sorry, continue. You're no, rolling.
No, I'm roiling.
So here's the thing. This is what we're going to kind of talk about. Just like, how did the Orioles get here? How is this so bad? And when we say here, we are talking about a team that currently has the second worst run differential in baseball, now having been blown out multiple times to an epic degree. Only the Rockies have a worse run differential, and yet somehow the Orioles, as we record this, have a worse team ERA than the Colorado Rockies. Marlins slightly worse, as they also got blown out by the Dodgers last night. But this was not the plan. We knew that the Rockies and the Marlins and the White Sox would be, you know, trading places at the bottom of whatever statistical category of your choosing. But now here we are, you know, a month into the season, and this Orioles team that we certainly were skeptical of parts of coming into the season are kind of just bad across the board. Of course, the pitching is the major culprit, but they're also, you know, 27th in team batting average and 25th in on-base percentage. And so, you know, they're hitting some home runs and there's parts of the offense that are still humming, but this is a true worst case scenario in terms of what's happening on the mound.
I'm going to give the offense a pass for the following reason. They have been behind early in games so often that they have not been given a real chance to kind of prove their worth yet. Like, I think this young offense is very talented and they have a lot of good pieces and they've had a lot of good things go right. Like, Ryan O'Hearn and Cedric Mullins have been really good. There are bright spots. But for the sake of this conversation, that's separate to me. If the Orioles pitching was mediocre and the lineup was underperforming, we could have that conversation. That's not what is going on. They have the second worst team ERA in baseball. They lost last night to the Yankees 15-3. Okay. two home games ago against the Cincinnati Reds, they lost 24-2. They are giving up runs at a shocking pace. And the worst part of all is that it's not a surprise. Okay. Over the winter, let's go to the winter. The Baltimore Orioles lost Corbin Burnes in free agency. And that was something of an expectation that this organization, it was unlikely they were going to commit big dollars to Corbin Burnes in the long run. And that, in some respects, was understandable. And Corbin Burnes, so far this year, has not looked good and would not have single-handedly saved the Orioles to this point in the season. Okay? I think we agree on that. But in replacing Corbin Burnes, Mike Elias, the general manager, fell woefully short in doing so, signing Tomoyuki Sugano from Japan, who has been much better than I expected as a 35-year-old junk ball artist. He was sensational against the Yankees on Monday night in a big Orioles win that now feels like it never happened. He also signed Charlie Morton for 1 year, $15 million. And right before spring training ended, signed Kyle Gibson for 1 year, $5 million. Okay. Kyle Gibson made his debut last night, and he was the victim of the Yankees' home run onslaught, surrendering homers to the first three batters of the game, another home run allowed in the first inning, and exited with 9 earned runs on his ledger. As far as I can tell, in Major League Baseball history, there are only 2 instances of a pitcher making their season debut allowing 4 home runs in the first inning of their first game of the year. Both of those instances have been this season against the Yankees. Kyle Gibson last night and Nestor Cortez in his first start in the Torpedo back game.
Which is to say, maybe that is, this says more about the Yankees than Orioles. However, as we just said, the Orioles team ERA is not this bad just because of last night. This has been an issue all season.
Now, I want to give them a little bit of leeway, the leadership group. There have been a ton of injuries. Zach Eflin, who started for them on opening day, currently on the IL. Kyle Bradish, who is a Cy Young finalist, top 5, actually, I believe, a couple years ago, still recovering from Tommy John. That is the case with Tyler Wells. Grayson Rodriguez has been a ball of injuries recently. He is on the IL with a lat strain and elbow inflammation. When they got Trevor Rogers, he has struggled with injuries since acquiring him at the deadline. Albert Suarez, who hoovered up innings for them a year ago, has been hurt. And so they are undermanned. That is not a problem unique to the Baltimore Orioles. As we know, the Los Angeles Dodgers a year ago won the World Series with a situation much worse than this. And I think the biggest issue that the fan base has right now is that because the Orioles offense, this squad of young talent, pried the window open, every year that goes by without the leadership group being aggressive on the pitching side to supplement that core is an enormous missed opportunity. Because those players, as they get closer to free agency, with so many of them being Scott Boras clients, it feels unlikely that they will sign extensions. That is Jordan Westberg. That is Jackson Holliday. That is Gunnar Henderson. And every year that goes on, those players get more expensive as they reach arbitration, as they earn more money through that process, and that bumps the whole payroll up. And so right now, this felt like the best opportunity to spend money on the pitching side, which they kind of did in giving Charlie Morton $20 million and Kyle Gibson $5 and Andrew Kittredge $10 and Sugano $13. Oof. And then offensively, yes, their free agents have been a catastrophe with Gary Sanchez getting $10 and Tyler O'Neill signing 3 years, $49 million. Okay. Mm-hmm. They spent the money. They had the biggest year-over-year payroll increase in baseball, percentage-wise. They just seem to have spent it in the worst possible way.
And I want to kind of dig in on that more, because it does feel like that is what is dominating the discourse, is being like, you idiots did not prepare, did not build around this offensive core correctly. And I think a lot of that criticism is totally valid. But you also mentioned something in there a little bit ago, and it's still early for a lot of these guys, right? But you say, okay, well, so then what should they have done? and you look at the top of the starting pitching market, right? And if you just, let's just focus on free agency here for a second, although I don't think that's the full conversation, right? But if you focus on free agency right now, it's a mixed bag, right? Again, we're a month into a lot of these long-term contracts, but you look at the top of that starting pitching market. Corbin Burnes has been objectively disappointing. Blake Snell, already hurt. Who knows when we're going to see him again? Max Fried, marvelous. Doesn't seem like the Orioles were remotely in consideration or pushing for Max Fried whatsoever. Maybe they should have been. And then you look at that next tier, and you got guys like Sean Manaea, injured, yet to pitch. Eovaldi, fantastic, right? Eovaldi would have been probably a better version of, okay, we don't want to give out a 9-year, you know, contract to a starting pitcher, or even 6 or 7 years, but there was more upside there, no matter what, than what you would be getting with a Morton, with a Sugano, with a Gibson. And you get into that Severino, Kikuchi, you know, Pivetta has been marvelous. Flaherty, another one. We all scoffed and said there's no way he's going to go back to Baltimore. Maybe that's true. But, you know, there have been other options here.
Even Yusei Kikuchi and Walker Buehler, who have ERAs around 4-3. 4-3?
Oh, boy, would we love a 4-3. But I think the other part of this conversation is on the trade side of things.
Yes.
Right?
Let me hop in here. Let me hop in here.
Yeah.
So when they acquire Corbin Burnes a year ago, before the 2024 season, spending real prospect capital to do so, that trade in retrospect could not have gone better. Corbin Burnes was everything that they paid for. He was fabulous all year, got Cy Young votes, was sensational in his one playoff start. On the flip side, the guys they traded away, DL Hall has been essentially nothing.
Basically a non-factor. Yep. Mostly due to injury, but that was part of his profile. Yep.
And Joey Ortiz, who was solid last year, has looked horrendous.
Awful.
So far.
One of the worst hitters in the league this year. Now that's still a guy that under contract for 4 or 5 years, good infield defender. He's something, but you're not sweating that one. And then they also traded a draft pick. Right?
They did, so, but then they recouped that draft pick, became Blake Burke, but they then recouped a draft pick after losing Burnes in free agency, which they knew was kind of going to be part of it. And so you label that move as like an unbelievable success, like a massive win, right? Yep. And then for some reason, they did not do it again, okay? They did not do a similar move. And there were pitchers who got traded, whether that is Jesus Luzardo, right? Whether they try and go get a guy like Dylan Cease, who seemed to be on the market. Now, we don't know what the prices were. Okay.
Well, but the Orioles, another big one.
Go ahead.
Crochet.
Right.
Right. There are only a few. And the reason why the Orioles in particular get the flack for this is because they are one of the few teams that are still in position to make a deal like this. They have the pieces. They have the prospects still now, including if you added in some players at the major league level.
But I think that is a relevant part of the story, is that when they made the Burnes trade, they were the number one system in baseball. It wasn't close, right?
Yep.
I think coming into this season, their farm system had taken something of a step back, partially due to graduations of players reaching the big leagues, like Jackson Holliday and et cetera, et cetera. And partially because some of the guys on the top of the list stagnated a little bit. Coby Mayo, right? Sure. Enrique Bradfield Jr. is interesting, but he's not like a no doubt top 50 prospect. They don't want to trade Samuel Basayo. I'm not saying it's a bad system. I'm just saying that maybe they still have the pieces to go make a move. They just didn't feel compelled or comfortable enough to do so because there was less depth. And I think that decision gets at the core of the issue of how the Baltimore Orioles are operating. They are doing something close to prospect hugging. Right? They are planning for a future that may not exist. They want to build something sustainable. And I think that that is commendable and admirable. But you know who doesn't want to give two hoots about sustainability? The me right now. I could slip on a banana peel tomorrow and be dead, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like fans want to see stuff now, especially for a fan base that hasn't won a World Series, seen a World Series since 1983. And Jordan Schusterman, now I'm going to get to the little nugget that I spent most of my morning working on.
Okay. Okay.
Do you know how many pitchers drafted in the Mike Elias era, the GM of the Orioles, have played for the Baltimore Orioles? Pitchers. we all agree mm-hmm. that Mike Elias and his staff have done a sensational, outstanding job with hitters. That is a fact, right? Now, they've drafted at the top of the draft a lot, but they have done a really good job. Pitchers. How many Mike Elias pitchers have appeared in the big leagues for the Orioles?
Appeared. So this is not made a start. And by the way, Mike Elias, I believe, has been there since 2018 or 19.
He was hired at the end of 18. So that is the 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24 drafts. 24, whatever, but it's six drafts.
Okay. So six drafts. How many of those pitchers have just made it to Major League Baseball?
For the Orioles.
For the Orioles. For the Orioles.
And I can tell you right now, they drafted 65 pitchers across those six drafts.
Okay. Oh, okay. So I know how many I'm within those 65. Okay. Now, and of course, the draft used to be was 40 rounds for the first part of that, and then it was five rounds, and then now it's 20 rounds. So this is all influenced. And I know for a fact they have taken primarily hitters at the top of the draft. So it's not like we're talking about,
a little more context on that. They, in terms league-wide, have taken the fifth fewest pitchers. Now, that is, clearly a strategy that they have employed. Yep. They know that they're good at developing hitters. They've leaned into that. I don't think that in and of itself is a problem. But they are fifth fewest with 65 pitchers ahead of only the Astros, Giants, Nationals, and Tigers. Okay. Mike Elias drafted pitchers to play for the Baltimore Orioles.
Okay. I mean, it's absolutely single digits. And I think the answer is probably like between four and six. But that even maybe is high because, again, you look at some of the guys that they've, even the success stories, right? We know Grayson was drafted before them. Bradish was a trade, a hell of a trade acquisition, right? We know that. A lot of these other guys were either international ones. And then even a guy like Brandon Young, who just made his debut, I know this is kind of a goofy trick question. I believe he was undrafted. So I guess you could still count him, but I guess he's not part of this. So I'm going to guess five is going to be my prediction.
Lower.
Lower. Okay. I mean, okay. Can't go much lower than that. Three.
Lower.
I guess, man. All right. Is it zero? Is it one?
It is zero. Not a single.
I forgot McDermott was a trade too. Oh,
there are some levers here that are conveniently pulled, and the Orioles did acquire a ton of pitching through trades over that time.
But which you get some amount of credit for, right? In terms of from a developmental standpoint, from a player acquisition, because that's part of the job, right? Identifying players.
Of course.
But draft and developing, this is a great. Wow, so it's zero. So who's even the closest?
Brandon Young feels like he should count a little bit because he was an undrafted free agent in 2020, right?
Okay. That feels like one,
I'm just
but
saying.
Sure, still, sure, yeah.
Drafted and debuted for the Orioles. Connor Gillespie was an Orioles draftee who has debuted elsewhere. He is the only Orioles draftee to show up elsewhere in the big leagues during this time.
God.
Cade Stroud was called up this week, did not get into a game, sent back down. He would have been the first. All right. Now, look, I understand that there was a lot of skullduggery there with my levers being pulled to make that fact.
But this is not a tiny, this is fine. This is clearly making a point, right? I mean, again, not to make this about my team. Look what the Mariners have been doing. I mean, they just pumped out another starter in Logan Evans, who was a 12th round pick 2 years ago. Like, there are other teams that are finding in this era of pitching development where you don't need to be picking at the top to find a. Of course, there's the Paul Skeens. Not everyone has access to Paul Skeens at 1-1, but it's 2025. You find pitchers from random places and you turn them into big leaguers. Like, that's what happens. Right. Not in Baltimore.
Not in Baltimore. And I just sent you the list of all the teams and the percentages and. You know, like the Marlins have had the most, and part of that is because they stink. And so they want to like bring guys up through the system. Part of that is because they're not bad at pitching development. But it's like, you know, Dodgers and Mariners and Braves are up near the top. Orioles are towards the bottom. And like that tells part of a story. Anyway.
Man, that part of a story. Yeah. I mean, that's not the whole story. Because I was going to say, let me bring it back to the to the offseason and then we can kind of wrap. So you can replay the offseason and say, or you could say, oh, why didn't you make these trades? Oh, why didn't you send these guys? But when you combine that with how poorly the guys they have added have gone, that's how you get here. right? I mean, as much as we could have been like, I don't know. Like, did we think Charlie Morton was going to be the worst pitcher in baseball?
No.
I didn't. And so now Kyle Gibson is a little bit more of a different one because clearly nobody else wanted him, like, at all. You know,
here's
like,
another thing whereas, about Kyle Gibson. Yeah. When they gave him $5 million, again, it's not my money. Who were they?
That's the thing. I don't understand. There were a couple contracts like that towards the end of the offseason, not just with them, where I'm just like, where is the leverage here? But with Morton, I mean, we've talked about it like 15, like these some other teams, again, not the, these other ones aren't exactly going great either, whether it's Cobb or Scherzer or Verlander, but it's not going this bad. And it is funny because Sugano was the one people were maybe the most skeptical of, and he's kind of doing his thing. But to, as you pointed out a couple days ago, it's like, that's an awesome story. Hell yeah, dude, like throw a bunch of garbage up there for 180 innings and have a 4 ERA. Like, that's impressive and fun to watch in some respects. You don't want to give that guy the ball in game one.
Guess what?
Like, guess let alone what? Game two or game, but guess what? That ain't going to matter. You can't, what game one? And, you know, right now you're headed towards, you know, last place.
Sure. How do they turn this around, right? From a pitching side? I don't know. I actually don't know because it's not as if there's a ton coming in the short term. Now, Eflin will get back soon. That will help. He is good. He is a good pitcher.
Good pitcher.
That is another example of the Orioles giving up prospects and acquiring a pitcher that worked.
Sure.
I believe Mac Horvath, who they gave up in that deal, had like 9 RBI this week in a game against Aberdeen, which is an Orioles affiliate.
And one of the other ones, Jackson Bowmeister, is also like, that's another guy who's...
Yeah, but
like
when you give guys to the Rays, you know that you're gonna probably gonna get burned.
See, it's funny I say that. Jackson Bowmeister has a 12 ERA in AA. So like, maybe it is about Mac Horvath. Never mind.
Prospects are just, you don't know, man.
Yeah. So Eflin is good. He should help. We get him back. That's something. But that is not, he is not going to.
We'll come back at some point. Wells will come back at some point. Trevor Rogers seemed, I think he gave up like 5 runs in one inning last night. Like, it's hard to envision this improving. You can see Cade Povich taking a step forward, but Sugano, Gibson, Morton, and Dean Kremer are what they are, right? They are what they are. They're not going to suddenly make all-star teams at this point. And so you look at how the front office has gone about constructing this team, and it has gone poorly in exactly the way people thought it was going to go poorly. Last thing, and then we'll take a break and welcome a pitcher the Orioles could use, Chris Bubich. Last night, Kyle Gibson, who by all respects is like the nicest dude. Just
totally. 100%. Like, nobody's rooting against Kyle Gibson.
No. When you ask players about other players, he's in the top tier of love that guy, right?
Yep.
5 home runs allowed last night, 5 different pitches.
Oh, man. Well, I mean, he's, again, that's a great fun fact that is both very good and also like, well, there's only so many pitchers that are throwing 5 different pitches. So you give yourself the opportunity to do that. Like, Spencer Strider will never do that. But that's not because he's good. It's because he doesn't throw 5 pitches.
Kenley Jansen.
Also, it's funny, by the way, I think the really sad part about this is that this is something that Sugano could replicate extremely easily.
Jordan, what's the home run tracker?
Right. So that's another part about last night's game, as 2 of my bold predictions appeared to be very much in play, as my Ben Rice 4 homer game, I mean, couldn't have gotten off to a better start, as he had 2 homers in, what, 2 innings?
The first innings? 2 innings. First 2 innings.
And I was like, holy crap, it's happening. And then also that the Orioles pitchers and hitters would combine for 500 home runs, which, again, has only happened in the juiced ball era. Last night was a productive night on the second. Ben Rice only finished with 2 homers. That was disappointing. But they're only on pace for like 415 right now, which, again, they had 410 last year. The problem right now, the starters are giving up homers. The relievers are not giving up homers. They haven't been very good, but they're not giving up homers.
No, you're wrong. The Orioles bullpen has been fine.
I mean, it's inflated by these few games. It's 27th in ERA, 29th in WHIP. Like, I know that like the main guys have been okay. It's inflated by some of these long relief outings. I get that. It's inflated by Charlie Morton coming in relief. And I understand. A lot of the main guys have been solid. No, it's true. It's I agree.
Right? When did they allow 24 runs to the Reds? That was last Sunday, right?
Yeah. I thought it was in the middle of the week, but yeah.
Before that, they were fifth in ERA.
Yeah. So again, it's inflated by a few things. So the bullpen's doing okay.
They're not
but
the problem.
It's really, for me, I need the offense to start picking it up. They're ninth in homers, yeah. But I was expecting them to be top five easily. So okay. Anyway, that's the Orioles. All right, let's table that. We'll come back to the O's.
Take
Hopefully
a breath.
That gets trends in a better direction, but not super optimistic. We're going to take a break. When we return, special guest Chris Bubich of the Kansas City Royals will join us. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbercast. Welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. We are now very excited to be joined by a special guest. He throws left-handed, and he is pitching quite well at the moment. That is Chris Bubich of the Kansas City Royals. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me.
So currently, right now, you are in Tampa Bay.
Correct.
And before we get into you and the Royals and kind of your specific pitching journey, what was last night like playing a Major League Baseball game in a spring training stadium?
Yeah, it was a little odd. The visual just was weird. The way the visiting side, at least for like the locker room and the dining area, it was all kind of spread out. The weight room and the cages were all kind of spread out, kind of like reminded me of COVID a little bit, because that's the time when I got called up. Everything was kind of just separate from each other. That's what it kind of felt like. I mean, the field itself is fine. It's a little weird. It just feels like you're playing in a double A or triple A park, to be quite honest. So it's a little less overwhelming than a massive big league stadium, but it is what it is. I understand the circumstance is tough.
Sure.
But it
makes sense. On the Royals broadcast last night, they were talking about how that the fields that are outside under the sun tend to play faster,
mm-hmm.
because like the dirt is getting cooked,
yeah.
all day. Was that something that, I know you didn't pitch last night, but like, did you notice that?
I did notice that the field itself actually, so like the dirt and the grass is a lot thicker, which it didn't necessarily, like you said, didn't necessarily play slower because of the thickness. It still played pretty fast to the infield. I mean, the outfield's not that big. Like, I'd say it's a good yard to hit, although the wind was blowing in last night, so it definitely helped. But I think just being in the southeast, like a lot of humidity, a lot of rain, I think just the thickness of the grass, the thickness of the dirt just absorbs probably, the water from the rain a lot better. So that's one of the things I noticed. Because I've never seen grass at least that thick. I mean, I'm really nitpicking here, but
no, it's fine.
Guy in the Northeast where we grew up, like you would just play on fields where the grass was thick because no one cut it in 3 weeks.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like, so yeah. That I've seen, but I understand this is a little bit different.
It's definitely still more forgiving though than I think. Playing on hard turf, like. At the Trop is, a little, it's not as forgiving on your body. When you play a 3-game series there, you're running on it, you're diving on it, whatever. So I think our infielders, outfielders probably appreciate, diving on grass than dirt. Or I mean, the Trop is dirt, but diving on a little, spongier, thicker grass than, some concrete feeling turf.
Yeah. We're still just adjusting to the aesthetic of like Cactus League teams playing in Grapefruit League stadiums like that. Mm-hmm. That on in and of itself is a strange adjustment. I know you as a player, it's more about the facilities and the amenities, but it's just like the Royals playing at the Grapefruit League Stadium is weird enough on its own. But hey, that's part of this season.
Yeah, I mean, I see Sacramento's kind of got a similar vibe to it. I think we go there at the end of the year. But like I said, I understand the circumstance, and they make do with what they have. And it's a nice yard for a spring training yard. It's just
Oh yeah,
from a standpoint of you go through a bunch of major league stadiums, some are really nice, and then it's just the visual. Yeah, like I said, is a lot different.
It's different. So let's get into your journey, because I think you are a very ideal person to kind of talk about the development of I mean, you personally, which we'll get into, but also just like the Royals, because having been drafted in 2018, you are one of the longest tenured people in the organization. I'm sure that probably feels weird to say, but you have kind of experienced both the personal growth and with the team, have seen it go from a team that was very, very much struggling collectively and especially on the mound to now that is one that is revered as one of the best pitching staffs in baseball. And you are, of course, a big part of that. So as someone who pitched a lot of innings and didn't have a lot of success, you know, before your surgery and, you know, before that with the team in general, to now being a part of one of the best pitching staffs in baseball, what has happened? What are the big changes that have kind of occurred that have kind of helped you personally and the team as a whole become very, very good at run prevention?
Yeah, I think the team as a whole has obviously trickled down to the individual level. I think, you know, 2022, I mean, I came up in 2020, COVID season. It's kind of weird. I only had one full season in the minor leagues. And I'll be honest, like, I wasn't expecting to be called up at that time. But considering, you know, I think we had an injury in the rotation at the time, and I just filled in as best I could, you know, throwing in the fire a little bit. And I had a good year in 2019, the minor leagues. But sometimes, and I think we have a better understanding of this now, stuff you do in the minor leagues doesn't always necessarily, even if you're having success, doesn't necessarily going to translate to the big league level. So how can you do something that's going to be sustainable? How can you, you know, have pitches and a pitch arsenal that's going to be sustainable, quality of contact, all that kind of stuff goes into it. So for me, I didn't really understand that at the time, but then, you know, I go through 2021, there's ups and downs. I'm like, I'm trying to give myself a little bit of grace. Like, you know, the team's not playing well. It's tough. It's tough sledding. 22, that was kind of like the bottom for me. I had a pretty bad year. Team didn't play well. That was my second. I got sent down for the second time because I didn't break camp in 21. So it was kind of like, that was like, okay, a point where I had to really reevaluate kind of where I was physically, pitching wise, stuff wise, and mentally, especially. So going into 23, we had got new pitching people on our side. So I think that kind of allowed me to hit the reset button a little bit, kind of talk with them about some things I wanted to bring to the table and some things they had in mind. One of that being a slider, just easier breaking ball to command. I had always been a fastball changeup guy going back to college and then early minors, especially.
That is something I think a lot of left-handed pitchers are taught from a young age, because you need to get righties out.
And for sure.
The way you do that is by having something that moves the other way. How long did it take you to like develop that slider as a pitch that you could get opposite handed hitters out with?
Yeah. So once I kind of toyed around with grips for a couple years, I had thrown, I got to college. I just threw a big, slow, loopy curveball. And then one of my teammates, actually Tristan Beck, who's been with the Giants, he threw a spike. So I kind of adopted a spike, and I've basically had a spike on all my breaking balls ever since. But going back to the slider, once I spiked it kind of on a certain part of the horseshoe, I kind of hold it sort of a sweeper grip. I guess I have two sliders now, but the one I'd thrown previously was sort of on a sweeper grip. I'd never really like tried to throw that, but just the way I threw, it felt good in my hand. Like, you know, came out of my hand well. And I feel like, okay, this is something I can work with. It's a little easier to command because the shape isn't as big as like a true over the top curveball. So I just got more swing reactions on it. You know, yes, it's nice to get swing and miss, but, you know, kept the ball on the ground. Like I said, I could get in better counts with it. Hitters, you know, took worse swings on it. So it was just, I knew it was going to play. And, you know, like you mentioned, being a left-handed pitcher kind of in the low 90s, like, you know, yeah, you're facing a ton of righties, fastball changeup, back and forth kind of plays. But I'd always had reverse splits. And granted, I still don't face that many lefties. But to have that now as a weapon, honestly, I throw probably more breaking balls now than I do changeups, which is nice. But
and the lefties that you do face tend to be like the guys who...
Yeah, play. Like the other day when I threw a sinker right down the middle to Yordan Alvarez. And I mean, that guy's going to...
Not the first time.
That guy's going to get everybody. I mean, he's gotten me before too. But for the most part, like I definitely feel more comfortable with the breaking balls facing lefties, even throwing it to righties too. But to go back to your guys' question about just the team itself, I think the culture really shifted kind of the same kind of time that it did for me, 22 to 23, when we, you know, brought in some new personnel, new staff. We still struggled in 23 because I was, you know, out with the elbow. So I was rehabbing, but kind of with the team all year. So I kind of saw it up close. But I think going into that next year, we really hit on the pitching free agent signings with Lugo, Waka, bringing in Lorenzen at the deadline last year and bringing him back this year. Like, those guys are like so steady, you know, so consistent. Like, you know what you're going to get each time they go out there. They're not necessarily like the flashiest guys, but that's not necessarily kind of our MO. That's not necessarily what we need. And for me, and, you know, a guy like Cole Reagans, who's a little younger, but obviously has some of the best stuff in the game, like, just to see the consistency and the day-to-day from them has really helped us kind of mold our routines to be consistent as well.
And my other question about just like, because again, I think people, the way you were throwing, especially in spring training this year, and understanding that you were going to kind of move back to the rotation, mm-hmm. it's easy to look at the narrative of, okay, he came back from surgery, he was awesome in the bullpen, and now he's going to be awesome in the rotation. But it does sound like you were already starting to kind of make those adjustments before the surgery. Is that fair to say? And then it seems like last year, when you have all that success in the bullpen, I don't know at what point you knew after that season that you were 100% going to be moving back to the rotation. But that's another thing that I'm curious about in terms of that, you know, dynamic and that communication between you and the team. I know the team made some moves in the offseason, like trading Brady Singer to kind of open up mm-hmm. a spot. But when you have all that success in the bullpen, is there part of you that's like, all right, maybe this is my thing? Or was it always clear that you were going to kind of move back to the rotation?
Yeah, last year, the way the rehab assignment for me kind of played out, I was starting for 90% of the rehab assignment. Mm-hmm. And I mm-hmm. could tell, like, with the way the starting rotation was going here in Kansas City, like, guys were shoving, like, you know, yeah, there's problem. No reason to change. Yeah, there's no reason to change something if it's going well. And I could tell, like, with the elbow, like, I'd get towards, like, you know, a higher pitch count in the outings, and, you know, I'd start to get a little fatigue naturally, just kind of stressed in that area for the first time again. So the last, let's say, 2 weeks or so of my rehab assignment, we kind of all together suggested, hey, what do you think about going to the bullpen? We'll schedule some outings for you down here, and then you come back and join us as like a multi-inning option. And I'm like, yeah, great. Like, I just want to pitch healthy and, right. you know, help you guys win. So I did that, got up. It was like right after the 4th of July last year. It was expected, like I said, to be a multi-inning option, started in some low leverage innings just to kind of get my feet wet, and it went well. And then kind of as we went along into July, August, September, like, we were in a pennant race, got some medium to high leverage innings. That multi-inning thing never really presented itself because our starters are, you know, throwing quality starts every time. There's not really a situation right. in which I got to go in and clean up, you know, a mess or something like that, or eat some innings.
Right, like Lugo's going eight, like, yeah. every start yeah, last
yeah.
Like,
not, yeah.
Like, it never,
so many innings.
Yeah, it never materialized. So, you know, it kind of turned into a one-inning guy. We got Ursig at the deadline, who's been money. And we kind of filled out the back end of the bullpen kind of late yeah. in the season, the playoffs. So it was quite the whole 180 for me, for the team. I can't imagine the team was expecting that either, kind of the way it played out.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of fun, I think, being able to pitch in high leverage situations, pitch in the playoffs in high leverage situations. Like, that stuff that really, you know, adrenaline gets you going. Like, you can't replicate that anywhere else. So, and I kind of saw how the stuff was playing too. Granted, you know, it's a shorter stint, one or two innings, like, you can let it eat a little bit more. And I'll be honest, like, I could recover a little bit better too, because I wasn't going back to back that frequently until the end. So I just felt maybe a little bit fresher than I did, you know, starting on my rehab assignment. But going into this year, I still wanted to keep the same mentality kind of in a starter's capacity, like a work capacity. So, like, for me, I'm attacking guys. Yeah. Is there going to be some, like, are you going to put up, you know, ridiculous numbers in, you know, over 150 inning sample? I mean, it's going to be hard. Probably not. But from the standpoint of just the process of attacking guys, getting in good counts, you know, trusting your stuff in zone. That's when I really started to notice like the stuff, even at like 92, 93, was playing in zone a little bit better than you'd probably expect. So, you know, in the starter's role now, that's kind of always in the back of my mind, like, hey, attack guys, the stuff's going to play up, fill it up in the zone and go from there. So that really helped me in the reliever mindset, kind of transitioning back to a starter.
I want to ask you about throwing in the playoffs. Like, you obviously pitched in big games in college, in regionals, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. Your sophomore and junior year. I don't think you were in Omaha either of those years, but in terms of the adrenaline of throwing in a postseason game, how did that compare to, one, big games in college, two, regular season games, and then three, like, your incredibly low intensity rehab process that you would basically like just finished? So I'm very curious to hear you kind of compare and contrast those.
There's nothing that compared to the playoffs. The energy in playing in places like Baltimore, New York, like, those are two pretty loud, pretty energetic places, especially New York. Like, everybody kind of knows how that is. But yeah, pitching in the regionals college, it was cool. But I think, like you mentioned, you know, not making it past the regional, I think it would have been even more so if we made it to the super regional in Omaha. But it is what it is. The regular season, yeah, I mean, some days there's not many people in the stands. I mean, it's pretty quiet. So you kind of get yourself going, but like, in you get to the playoffs, there's 40,000-50,000 people screaming their heads off. We're playing in all these close games too, and it's like, you kind of know, hey, like, I got to be on it here. I got to come in, you know, firing away right away. Like, I got no time to waste. So the sense of urgency, the awareness is really heightened compared to the regular season, compared to the rehab assignment, compared to college. Like, that's something I'll always remember. And you kind of get out there and I'm almost like, I mean, there's a little bit of jitters that come with it, just because it was a lot of our first taste of the playoffs. So getting to experience that, well, yeah, that was something else.
And you threw like a lot relatively, yeah. Like, you pitched in both of the Baltimore games in a one run game in the eighth, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
like, welcome to the bullpen, Chris.
Yeah. So it was kind of funny. So we were pushing to make the playoffs the last week of the season. We were in DC and then Atlanta. In DC, that was like, I want to say we swept the series, but they were all super close games. I pitched two out of three there. Lucas Ursaig pitched all three games in DC. We lost Friday night in Atlanta, but we still clinched because I think Minnesota lost. So we were like staying there waiting to, you know, celebrate and whatnot. So that kind of gave, but it was nice because that kind of gave us a couple days to reset. I ended up pitching the last game of the season, getting a save for the first time ever. So that was cool. But so that gave me like a bridge outing to the playoffs, because I knew, you know, it's all hands on deck in the playoffs. Like, you know, we're going to be available. We know, like, kind of our style of play is to play a lot of low scoring games. You know, our pitching and defense often carries us. So we kind of know the expectation going in. And then, yeah, New York too. I think I didn't pitch game one, but I pitched two innings in game two to bridge the gap there to Lucas at the end. But yeah, I mean, in the moment, you don't really feel fatigue, but then after you're done, it's like, man, like you said,
you're exhausted, just like mentally and physically.
I kind of imagine, like, this is like how I felt like the Monday after my wedding, where I was like, I remember waking up and being like, I am so mentally fatigued. Like, and in the moment, your adrenaline is just pumping the whole time, that you're not thinking about how tired you are. You know, like, it's, oh, it's 12:30, like the night of my wedding. Like, we're having a great time. And then you wake up 2 days later. Yeah. You feel like you got hit by a truck.
Yeah. Yeah. It's somewhat similar, like the physical standpoint of just getting up every day, like, you know, what's at stake, and the mental just being so locked in, because you never know what inning, like, just because I'm pitching late in games, you never know.
Right.
Starters have a shorter leash typically, so I could be coming in the fourth inning instead of the seventh or eighth. So it's like every pitch, you're just, you know, in a zone. So it's exhausting, but like I said, it's something I'll never forget.
So my last question for you, which is a kind of a good way to big picture wrap this up, because you describe your personal journey. But again, getting back to the fact that you've been in the organization since 2018, having, I believe, played more major league seasons than anyone else in the roster with the Royals, except for Salvi, which is kind of an amazing thing.
Yeah.
How has just
Since the three of us were born?
Right. So, true. You know, he's and a couple of the other guys have been. I know, like, Mike Hell's been in the organization for a long time. Freddie Fermin in the organization for a long time. But again, you said those were some lean years. You guys lost a lot of games, and then there you were, you know, in the playoffs, winning a playoff round. How has that been, knowing what it, you know, kind of came from? And then also, because we can't help but bring it up, and I know you get asked about it all the time, how much has Bobby Witt Jr. just, like, kind of changed what it means to be a Royal? You know, not to give him too much credit, but just, like, getting to watch that and how he, with his rise, has kind of come along. As we mentioned, the pitching is a huge part of the story, but he's a big part of that story as well.
For sure. When you get guys like Bobby, guys like Salvi, like, faces of the franchise, those are Bobby especially, that's the guy you build around. Like, you watch him play every day. You watch his at-bats every day. You watch some of the defensive plays he makes. It's just, you know, every time he goes up to the bat, he's got a freaking 20-game hitting streak right now. Like, just, and he didn't get a hit till his last at-bat last night. So it's like, every time you go up there, you just know it's going to be a competitive at-bat. Anytime, like, the ball's hit in his general area, if I'm pitching, like, okay, I know I got a chance to make that play. So just having a guy like that, super humble guy, like the guy you want, like, leading a team, and just to see what he can do on a field, it's just incredible. So I think, yeah, that really sets the table for everybody else.
But I'm just curious, because, like, he gets drafted the year after you, and obviously you want all your first round picks to turn into superstars, but you don't really know, especially in baseball, if they are going to really change the franchise. Was there a point when either you saw him for the first time or heard about it, where you're like, oh, wait a minute, like, this is truly going to, like, kind of change what we are capable of in some senses, either before you saw him or once he debuted?
I think in 22, opening day, he made the team. We've opened at home, I think, for like 6 years in a row. I can't remember opening on the road, but I just remember, like, the roar, like we usually sell at opening day, the roar of the crowd when he got called up to bat. I'm like, okay, this is different. This is, like, different than anything kind of I've heard the last few years. Obviously, that was his first at bat in the big league, so you didn't really know what was going to happen. But just to see the reception, yes, the expectations were super high, but, you know, that's a guy who can, you know, surpass those pretty easily, just because the type of guy he is, the character he shows. Like, so seeing the reception he got, the roar of the crowd, like, okay, this is a guy that this is going to be the guy. Like, he can do anything.
And that game, he hits a go-ahead double in the eighth inning of a tie game for his first big league hit.
Like, so it's kind of like, okay, I mean, the moment's not too big. You know, the at-bats are going to be, incredible. He can run, you know, as fast as anybody. Like, he literally can do everything. Nothing he does on a baseball field, I think, you know, you can ask our whole team, like, anything he does now is pretty... It's like, oh, it's not that shocking. Like, we've seen something like that before, because he does it so frequently. It's incredible.
Yeah. Dude, the first year of him was so remarkable, because he's a top three player in the world now. He didn't really know what he was doing yet. Like, he he was relying so much on natural ability, because, you know, he zoomed up the system, and, like, he's 22 years old, and I'm looking at his, like, he was a league average hitter as a 22-year-old, not having any idea how to, like, work an at-bat or, like, you know, have mature plate discipline. And, like, the second that kicked in, it was like, oh, my gosh. Like,
yeah.
This is nuts.
Yeah, I think that just speaks to him as a mature individual, like, so young, but kind of, you know, talent gets you there, but, you know, the hard work, the process keeps you there. So I think him refining the at-bats, kind of the approach, the defense, like, it's just, you know, it was only a matter of time before, you know, everything clicked, and obviously everything has clicked to what he is now.
My last question is, have you faced him in inter-squads in spring?
Uh, I think I faced him in, I don't think I faced him this spring in like live at bats, stuff like lives, that. Yeah. But I think he's hit, I mean, he always hits the ball hard. So he's hit a couple balls hard off me. I know that. I can't remember probably where they went. I don't think I've given up a home run, thankfully, but anything in play, he's probably going to have a hit. So yeah. At least a couple hits.
That's fair. That's fair. Chris Bubich, this was a delight. It's good to catch up with you. Having talked to you back at the Futures game, knowing the ups and downs of your career, it is quite cool to see the success that you've had, and hopefully you and the Royals can keep it rolling this year. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me. A lot of fun.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. You thought Jake was mad before? Well, get ready, friends, as it's time to talk about the latest release of a brand new, spanking new, fresh City Connect jersey, courtesy of the very bad Chicago White Sox. The White Sox, once again, on pace for a horrific season. Nobody cares because the Rockies are worse. And they announced this weekend, we're getting a whole wave of new City Connect uniforms this year. And this one has really struck a chord with my co-host. He has already angry tweeted about it, and now he is going to angry podcast about it, as these White Sox City Connects are just Bulls jerseys. Yes, this is these are not any sort of remix or tribute. They have essentially just taken Chicago Bulls jerseys and they have turned them into baseball uniforms. This has made Jake Mintz rather angry, and I understand disappointed a lot of people. I think there are some people that might like them, and then maybe I'll play devil's advocate here in a second, but I'll kick the rock to you. I'll kick the basketball here to you to talk about these basketball jerseys, Jake. Tell me what you think, and I'll read some of what the what state media is saying, what the White Sox are saying about these jerseys. But what are you thinking?
Oh, not the Kremlin. I want to know what the Kremlin thinks about this. Here's the deal, friends. These are not White Sox jerseys.
No, they're not.
They're Bulls basketball jerseys. It's that simple. They actually, in my opinion, they don't look bad. I like the way these look, because the Chicago Bulls are an iconic franchise with a good design and motif and colorway. Guess what? The Chicago White Sox have a different one. They have a different one. I think this would play differently for me if these two teams were not owned by the same incompetent human being, Jerry Reinsdorf. And they would play differently for me if the White Sox weren't a poop avalanche of an organization right now.
And by the way, the Bulls aren't exactly covering themselves in glory recently either.
But it's literally an attempt to be like, hey, remember the 90s when MJ was cooking?
Yeah.
Like, this is to me the equivalent of, during a White Sox game, pointing the camera at Scottie Pippen and letting the crowd cheer for him. But you have to wear that. It's like they do this sometimes. You'll see it online, like reimagining all the baseball teams as soccer jerseys, or a giveaway day. Like, I've seen Orioles jerseys in Ravens colorways, or, I was going to say Pirates jerseys in Steeler colorways, but that's the same thing.
Sure. Sure.
You've seen this before, and those are cool, and those get people excited. Like, oh, the Mariners do, like Washington State night, and they give Mariners hats in like the wazoo colors, right? That's okay. This is different. Why am I mad? Why am I so mad about it? Like, I am not a hater. If you listen to the show and you know me, you know I'm not. I don't wake up and drink haterade, right? I drink coffee, right? I drink water,
right?
Not haterade. Why is this bugging me? As someone who doesn't live in Chicago and is not a White Sox fan.
Right. So I think the two things that we need to get at here, you hit on one of them, which I think is important. But Let's read what White Sox Chief Revenue and Marketing Officer Brooks Boyer said. One of the quote, one of the challenges we had coming out of having our first Southside City Connect jersey, right? So this is the second edition that we've seen. And the Southside ones were also kind of controversial is the wrong word, but I'm not sure everyone loved them initially, but it seems like people have come around on them.
They were polarizing visually. I generally liked them.
Sure. But it was like Southside. Like that's the thing that's the White Sox, right? That's okay. Makes sense. Southside. Great. One of the challenges we had coming out of that was, quote, how could you ever match it or top it? One of the thoughts that was pushed right away was that no one has ever done a collaboration between a Major League Baseball team and an NBA team. In a market like Chicago with the history of both teams, how great would it be to be able to collaborate with our partners in the Bulls, along with Nike and Fanatics, to do something that is unique and very different? And the problem is that it just rings so hollow when, one, it's not unique and different because you just took the Bulls jerseys, and two, you're owned by the same team. So it doesn't even come across as like a genuine, like two sides came together very like purposefully. Like that is a collaboration that was not almost, I'm trying to think of the right word, but internal, like something that was like more obviously put together. It just feels like something that was smashed together because they're all under the same conglomerate. Whereas if there are teams, I'm sure there are teams owned by different people in different cities that have strong relationships with each other. If you had managed to pull off a collaboration in that respect that still ended up looking different and had elements, there's probably a version where they do this that had elements of the Bulls. Again, it would be hard to take seriously because they're all owned by the same people, but there's probably versions to do that. However, this this is not that. And then when you combine it with what is the part that makes me laugh the most, on the collars, the years of all the championships between the two franchises, which of course for the Bulls was a lot of them reasonably recently. However, for the White Sox, they managed to also include their championship in 06 and 17, to which you might say, what are you talking about? Oh, right, 1906 and 1917, which is just lumped on the same collar with all the 90s Bulls championships. And of course, their 05 World Series that is respectfully probably the one that the fewest people remember from this century. Not taking anything away from it. Very cool. Ended a long drought. Happy for those fans. But not one that, of course, a lot of people, you know, stands out. Anyway, it's just trying to kind of lump together a franchise, as you said, that is celebrated, that does have a lot of recent history of winning, and just kind of jumping on and dragging them into the mud and being like, we're like them. We're great. Remember our 1917 champ?
Who can forget it? Now, look, they're going to sell so much of this stuff because it looks cool. Like,
Which is also always the point. Let's also remember that.
Yeah, we're selling stuff.
Okay. This is America.
That's okay. Stuff. Yeah. We're selling you stuff. Podcast content. Right. Mm-hmm. Thanks for listening. But like, people will buy this because it looks cool. And maybe I'm thinking too hard about this. But you know what else looks cool? Bulls jerseys. Basketball Bulls jerseys, not baseball Bulls jerseys.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe another funny thing. I don't know.
Another funny thing.
White Sox fans, let us know.
This quote you said, one of the challenges we had coming out of our first Southside City Connect jersey was how you could ever match it or top it. I read this quote almost as one of the challenges we had coming out of our first Southside City Connect jersey was that to design the next one, we were coming off the worst season in baseball history. Big challenge in designing a uniform.
The last point I'll make on this is I was like, oh, like what are the Bulls like saying about this? So I went to the Bulls Twitter feed, although I guess now I'm curious about their website as well. Like, is there any acknowledgement of this collab? I'm not seeing it on the website, and it just seems like they just retweeted the White Sox tweet. So
amazing.
I do wonder if there was like, there were people in marketing with the Bulls. I know they're owned by the same people, but they're like, oh yeah, awesome. Like we get to be associated with the White Sox. That's awesome. Thanks guy. Appreciate it. Cool. Nice. Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 I'll retweet it for sure. For sure. Yeah. 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 Definitely. Cause by the way, the Bulls, it's not like the Bulls are busy right now. Like their season's been over. It's not like they're busy posting, you know, playoff highlights. So in theory, they could be getting behind this and like really pumping it, but that's not happening. At least
also, correct me if I'm wrong, the Bulls are not on the south side.
Well, that's another part of this. I mean, I guess they're farther south than like Wrigley Field.
Yeah, but I don't think they're closer to Wrigley Field than they are.
I don't know Chicago nearly as well as you do, so I'm going to tap out of this conversation and geographically defer.
Anyway, here's the thing. These
point is, we're, like I said, I don't think they look that bad.
No. But
it's not born in some sort of something we've never seen before.
Hey, can you
to me, that's really where you're, that's really where you are hitting it with the City Connects, is like a clear diversion. There was creative thought, and it's not something I've ever seen or expected. So it's different. And sometimes it just looks goofy and people make fun of it, whatever, but I'd still rather that. I'd still rather it be something that I've never seen before and clearly was created. There was an actual creation and an innovation. There was something that was produced that did not previously exist. That's not what happened.
I think the new Giants ones are kind of stinky, but they took a shot. Okay.
Yeah.
They totally sat in a room and they said, what about this? They said,
came up with stuff.
Correct.
That is not what occurred here. And that is what is frustrating.
Can we talk about something that makes me happy?
Yeah. A couple more things before we say goodbye. Let's just quickly talk about this. Normally, I'm not one like, oh, let's talk about a highlight on a baseball podcast because it's like, I don't know. Wow, what a catch.
Look at
the Dalton Varsho play was so unique. Wonderful. And unique. Also because it was his first game of the season. And I love a play where it's like, he screwed up. And it's like, okay, he screwed up. But the fact that he made the play is also reflective of the kind of defender that he is, you know. It's like somehow it managed to display both his talents and then also put him in a very goofy position. If you haven't seen the play, Dalton Varsho, center fielder, one of the best outfield defenders in the world, in his first game back, because he's been injured for the first month, he ranges back and he just falls and tumbles in very kind of juvenile fashion and somehow manages to still track the ball and catch it, and then like almost put the ball behind his back, or at least it looked like it. I know he kept the ball in his glove, but that was like an extra added layer of flair that I didn't really understand, but it made the highlight all the better.
He put some hot sauce on it, NBA Street style. Like he caught the ball in like an awkward position and just like smoothly transitioned the ball behind his back. If you hate on this highlight, I get it, because it is not like a difficult out. It's not a difficult batted ball to turn into an out, right? When you look at like the catch probability, you know.
Sure. The ball was in the air a long time.
Sure.
You know.
Still, and it looked Savannah Banana-ish. But
it
still.
It did.
Watch it. It's sick. It's so cool.
It's so great. But it was also a great contrast because we had two other unbelievable center field catches last night. Buxton in Cleveland and Tyrone Taylor in Queens, and the Tyrone Taylor one was, I mean, that is about as full extension as you're going to see. And that was pretty badass.
So in regards to Varsho, you're saying you liked this because it was an example of a player screwing up and yet succeeding anyway in the outfield. Could you do me a favor and turn over your right shoulder?
Has this guy done that before?
Yoenis Cespedes.
That is known as a, I mean, that's what he did all the time. Now, I will say, though, like, but the reason I'm pointing that out is because I know some people, you mentioned, like, the catch probability. Oh, he didn't have to dive. He had a bad read. But this wasn't a bad read. He just fell down. Like, it wasn't like, it's not like this was reflective of, like, he went the wrong way. Like, he tripped and looked like a fool and still had the dexterity and focus to make the play. So
goofy, still impressive. There was a Cody Bellinger play earlier this year to end a game where he made like a full extension catch.
Yes.
That was very cool looking. And the catch probability on it was like 95%. And he just had a terrible jump in the other direction and whatever.
Right.
And in that circumstance, everyone's asking Aaron Boone, how about that play? He's like, oh, it's amazing. And it's still an amazing play that I and you and most human beings couldn't make. and it's still cool and exciting, right? Mm-hmm. This feels different mm-hmm. to me because it's the recovery aspect of it is so
yeah, it's great. So Dalton Varsho, nice to have you back. Jorge Polanco, two more homers last night. He has a 260 WRC plus. The fact that he's doing this, he has an oblique injury, so he can't bat right-handed as a switch hitter, and he can't play defense right now, and it doesn't matter. Davey Andrews had a great story on Fangraphs this week that I encourage people reading about kind of the stance changes that Polanco has made that seem subtle, but clearly have put him in a better position to succeed. And the Mariners are kind of hitting. I mean, Jorge Polanco is doing most of the dirty work, but he has been unbelievable. And I just, what a strange last year or so for Jorge Polanco. And then the last thing I will mention before we say goodbye is I'm writing about the NL West this week because the Giants and Padres are playing just two games. It's a little two-game set. A little bit strange. Just means we're going to get a couple opportunities, four-game series with them later on in the season, which is certainly exciting. But I'm writing about just kind of the weaknesses of these four NL West contenders. Not going to focus on the weaknesses of the Rockies because I don't have that many words to work with, but just some strange quirks in the schedule for the NL West, which is basically that these teams don't even play each other until, like, for the first time until June. And then I wanted to highlight specifically the Giants and Padres second half schedules. Listen to this schedule for the San Francisco Giants in September. Okay, this is just one of the strange, again, because this is part of product of the balanced schedule, but this is also just fluky. In September, the Giants only play four different teams. Okay, this is their September schedule. They go Rockies, Cardinals, D-backs, Dodgers. D-backs, Dodgers, Cardinals, Rockies. That's how they finish the season, which is just a very strange way for the schedule to fall. And then the Padres in August, this is interesting. They have a run in the middle of August. So they start with the D-backs, then they go to then they have the Red Sox, and then they go at Giants, at Dodgers, home for Giants, home for Dodgers. So it's just like this 20-game stretch
wow.
all against the division. So NLS is going to be fun this year. I know the D-backs have started to slip, but I still think that they're going to be factors. So just keep an eye on those because right now we're not getting those interdivision matchups. But once we get them, they're going to be very fun to watch. That's it. I have some, I think I know what I want to do for Friday's pod, but we will have to confer and discuss accordingly. I will be in Boston, Massachusetts, so that's exciting.
We have...
But until... Yeah,
we've received all your emails about six-game sweeps, and that will be on Friday.
Yes. We'll do it. Yes, we'll finalize our selection for that, and also all the Sabres feedback is so funny, and perhaps we will talk more about that on Friday as well. But until then, thank you to Chris Bubich for joining the podcast. Thank you to TJ Brassel for producing, and we will talk to you all later this week.